This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, we learn about hard water sailing. It's a winter sport that involves ice, adrenaline, and a good strong breeze. Now, there are many reasons why someone turns to consuming or creating poetry. For our next guest, the natural world and the Midwest have been enduring sources of inspiration and motivation to write. Janet Ruth Heller is president of the Michigan College English Association. She previously served as president of the Society for the Study of Midwestern Literature and spent decades teaching writing courses and women's studies at numerous higher education institutions. She's an author and playwright and a Wisconsin native. Her fourth and latest book of poetry is called Nature's Olympics. Janet, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very glad to be here.
Oh, the pleasure's ours. And I want to start by just asking about, and it's a personal question, because sometimes I look at my writing from just a few years ago and I embarrass myself and nobody else needs to even see it. But your new volume of poetry contains works that go back to when you were an undergrad. Why did you want to collect these works that take place over such a span of time?
Well, I'm a big saver. So I've saved all of my work since high school. And while I think I've become a better writer over the years, but I've gone back to some of my earlier work and it surprises me. I mean, there are really some good images. I started writing haiku poems in high school when I was in Milwaukee, and I continued when I was a student at University of Wisconsin-Madison and a graduate student there. And one of the poems I'm going to read you today, I wrote when I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I revised it a little bit, but it's basically the same poem that I wrote when I was in my 20s.
All right, well, let's not hold back then. Please, Janet Ruth Heller, bring us one of those poems.
Okay, it's called Snow Poem. Languid flakes cover familiar images, bringing me metaphors in crystalline form. Trees resemble giant white flowers. Among their branches, light plays hide and seek. Fog bites off the heads of distant buildings like a hungry dragon. Snow arches over windows and doors, sketching bushy eyebrows and mustaches. Cars huddle like moles, blinded by the storm. Bicycles become cubist statues. Like a witch, I hoard all the images for my winter brew.
Janet Ruth Heller with her poem, Snow Poem, from her new book of poetry, Nature's Olympics. Janet, the imagery is undoubted. You can't deny it, but it also harkens back to the Midwest and the changing of the seasons, which your book of poetry has chapters for all seasons. How is that nature and the main theme of these poems? How have your views on the natural world changed over these times?
I don't think my views have changed all that much. I've always found nature a source of comfort and fascination. My dad would take me for walks when I was a little kid, and he'd say, you know, this is an oak tree, and that's a deer, and that's a squirrel. And he really gave me his love of nature. And that has lasted my whole life. I'm 72 now. So I think there's been very little change. I think my love of nature has just deepened. And as I've gotten older, I've done research about different birds and animals and plants. So I certainly know more than I used to when I was a toddler and first started taking walks with my dad.
And has the pandemic defined or redefined what reading and writing poetry does for you?
Well, nature has certainly been a comfort during the pandemic. And in the early days of the pandemic, when we couldn't go to many public places, I would take walks outdoors, and the natural world seemed to be ignoring the pandemic. And it was sort of amusing and comforting, and sort of a source of stability at a time of trauma.
That the natural world in some ways became a natural escape for the pressing feeling of the pandemic that was surrounding us.
Yes. And when I would take walks, I would encounter other people. There are trails near me for bicyclists and hikers. And I would run into many people on the trail and say hi. And I make some new friends. And it's very pleasant.
Janet Ruth Heller, what recommendations would you make for other people to get into reading or writing poems?
I think it's a good idea to write as often as possible. Many writers, including me, keep a journal, and that way you can write about your ideas each day. And I use many of the details from my journals in my poems. In general, writing as often as possible is a good idea. And also, I'm involved in a writer's group that meets every month, and it motivates me to make sure that I have something written for the group. And I think that's good. And I also get very good feedback from the other professional writers in the group. We all are published writers, and we give one another solid, constructive criticism. And I find that very useful. Many of the poems in Nature's Olympics I've revised with the help of my writers group.
And finally this afternoon, Janet Ruth Heller, if we could go out on a warm note and usher in some spring, would you be able to read something for us from your book's spring section?
Sure. This poem is called Disorientation, and it's about some animals we saw in our backyard. All June, a doe bounds into our yard at midday and stays for an hour. Have heavy rains confused her nocturnal clock? The doe devours violet leaves, beheads hosta, roses, lilies, and phlox. Why is she so hungry? Why does she tarry here? Then one afternoon, she gallops across our lawn, and trotting behind her, a tiny fawn.
Janet, thank you so much for sharing your poetry and words with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. It was great.
Like a witch, I hoard all the images for my winter brew. Janet Ruth Heller is president of the Michigan College English Association. She's talked with us today about her most recent book of poems, Nature's Olympics. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on an Olympic hopeful from Pulaski.
If you're competing in the biathlon at the Olympics, you have to be really good at not just one, but two sports, Nordic skiing and rifle shooting. Biathlete Deidre Irwin explains.
You skate ski with a modified 22 long rifle that you carry on your back, and you stop on a range and you shoot the targets and hopefully hit them all so you don't have to do any penalty laps.
Irwin is making her Olympic debut as one of eight members of USA's biathlon team. She's also one of three biathletes with Wisconsin ties. Back in high school, the Pulaski native joined the Ashwaubenon Nordic ski team to supplement her running habit. She skied competitively in college, where her friend and current teammate encouraged her to try biathlon. She got hooked, and in addition to being an Olympian, she is also a Vermont National Guard biathlete. I recently talked with Irwin via Zoom while she was in Italy, where her team had just competed in the BMW IBU World Cup.
Good shooting from Didier Irwin.
USA's women's relay team placed fifth, which is the best finish they've had in decades.
What a great day for the American team, 50 seconds behind. I think that was Joanne Reed screaming with joy there as she crossed the line.
I was crying at the end of the relay last weekend, just like so excited because last year we had a sixth place and we all were like, holy crap, that's crazy. And this year now we have a fifth, and it just sort of sees this progression that our team is able to compete at such a high level throughout the world, even though our sport maybe isn't the most popular in the U.S.
So why do you love competing in biathlon?
One of the reasons that I was really drawn to biathlon was just the passion of all of the administrators I had met and the coaches and the athletes. And then when I actually got to compete internationally at one of my first World Cups, I like walk through this tunnel and then all of a sudden I look over and there's just like 30,000 fans just like screaming and like partying, and it was like being in a football stadium back in Wisconsin, and I'm just like, they're here for us, you know. It was just such a cool thing to experience and see. And then it's also just so challenging. On any day, anybody can clean a race and place so much higher than they normally do.
It's also interesting to me that biathlon has only been in the Olympics for a few decades, because to me, it seems like one of the more practical winter sports. Like, at its core, it's extreme survival skills. You ski fast and you shoot.
Yeah. And I think that's why, like, for me, it can be part of the military, because it is a military training exercise. That's kind of how it got developed from the Norwegian army to become such a hit. I mean, I think it's the most watched winter sport in Europe.
Can you talk about how you approach a race? It's fascinating to watch how you find that balance between really exerting yourself and racing fast, but not overexerting yourself. Like, if you're exhausted, I assume that throws off your shooting.
And that in there lies the question. How do you do that? Because for me, I'm still figuring it out. Every year I've kind of gotten a little bit faster at skiing. And I've noticed that if I do that too much, you're right, I come into the range and I'm a little too breathing too heavy. The barrel's moving a lot more. I can't really get it in sight. So that's really the name of the game, how to balance being efficient and fast in skiing and being able to flip that switch when you get to the range and become a focused precision shooter.
What are your goals with these winter games?
First step was obviously just making it. And since then, I've been able to kind of think about, you know, what kind of realistic goals I can have. So I don't really expect myself to be podiuming or anything in individual events unless something really crazy happens. But I really want to focus on the relays. And I think that our relays are just getting better and better. And I really believe in this group of the four women we have here. And I think we can really pull together something magical.
Deidre Irwin is a member of the USA's biathlon team and a Pulaski, Wisconsin native. She'll be competing in at least three races at the Olympic Games in Beijing. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And coming up, these winter athletes don't mind sliding on the ice either. It's the sport of ice boating, and that's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and coming up later tonight at 6 on 1A+, why does love hurt? Jen White speaks to a science writer, Florence Williams, on what connects emotional heartache and real physical pain, a love story that matters to anyone who has a heart. Hey, that's me. Plus, The View from Kyiv, that's tonight at 6 on 1A+. Now, you might think sailing is at least a few months out, but there are a group of Wisconsin sailors braving the ice, wind, and snow this winter. Perhaps you've seen them. They're part of a sport called hard water sailing, whose daring participants travel up to 100 miles per hour as they glide over frozen lakes. Joining us to explain ice boating is Commodore Daniel Hearn. He heads up the Four Lakes Ice Yacht Club in Madison. And Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want you to take us through the experience of being you out there on that ice. How do the wind, ice, and the boat all interact out there?
Well, of course, ice sailing is a bit of a fickle sport. It's sometimes difficult to get all the factors to line up, but when they do line up, it is an amazing experience. So, of course, first we need ice. We look to have at least 4 or 5 inches, particularly for the larger boats. We're looking for ice that has no to little snow on it. We have to, of course, avoid seams that develop in the ice. We need wind. And then, of course, we need time off work. So add them all up. It's hard to find all those lining up, but it's truly amazing when they do.
Now, you're the Commodore of the Four Lakes Ice Yacht Club, which has been building and racing boats for more than 100 years. Give us a little bit of a brief history of hard water sailing in Wisconsin.
Well, I'll even go back a little bit further than that. Ice sailing originated in Holland. Originally, they took their summer, their wooden summer boats, and they constructed a platform and dropped their boat right onto the platform and put some runners or skates on it, and they used it for moving stuff around in the winter, and then it became a recreational pursuit as well. When ice sailing began in this country and in Wisconsin, The boats that they were sailing at that time were very large, very heavy, and they were called stern steerers, and named because the steering runner was on the stern of the boat. Modern boats, typically the steering is at the front of the boat. They're dramatically lighter. They're built out of composite materials, primarily carbon fiber, and they're very high tech versus the boats that they were sailing 100 years ago. So in Wisconsin, the boats have been sailing on many of the inland lakes for many years, including the Madison Lakes and Lake Geneva and Oshkosh and any of the bigger lakes around the state.
Daniel, how long have you been doing this now?
I started hard water sailing about 2006.
How'd you come across it?
Well, I race catamarans in the summer, and I live in Madison on Lake Monona, and saw the boats out there tearing around, and I thought, wow, that looks like a lot of fun and a way to extend my sailing season. So I checked it out, and before I knew it, I was building my first boat, and now all these years later, I race in four different ice boat classes. I'm a builder, so I build a fair number of boats, and not only do I race in Wisconsin and around the U.S., I've also raced internationally as well.
As I understand it, Daniel Hearn, you're actually ranked internationally as of the 2020 Gold Cup, and you've placed in places as far away as Lithuania, Poland, Sweden. Curious what it's been like to go around the globe as a hard water sailor and what you find. What are the like minds that you come across in hard water sailing around the world?
It is truly an international community. Ice sailing has allowed me to forge friendships from all over the world. People who are from, you know, very different walks of life and different cultures, but all sharing a common passion. And it's truly remarkable. I have very good friends in Poland and Sweden and Hungary and Germany and Lithuania and many other, you know, cold weather countries. And typically the sailors are very helpful. It's not easy logistically to get equipment and, you know, travel all over within Europe, for example, to get to where the ice is. And it's a truly remarkable community that helps each other out in that regard.
Daniel Hearn is Commodore of the Four Lakes Ice Yacht Club, and you can find Daniel racing his ice boat on Madison area lakes and lakes around the world, as mentioned. But just this past weekend, Daniel, a regatta in Madison was canceled because of poor ice and wind conditions. And as you explained this hard water sailing to me, it sounds incredibly dangerous. And you laid out what would be perfect conditions. How often do you come across those conditions in Wisconsin, and how important are they for things like safety?
Well, it typically goes in streaks. The way it works is, of course, the lakes further north freeze earlier, and the lakes that are deeper freeze later. So typically the season starts further north in Wisconsin and, you know, up into Minnesota as well. And then as those lakes get snow covered, we're starting to move south and also to the deeper lakes. So if you're willing to travel, you typically get in a very good amount of sailing in a season. If you're unwilling to do that and are just waiting for everything to line up in your backyard, it's a little bit more challenging. But the Madison area or southern Wisconsin is really one of the epicenters of ice sailing in the world. We just happen to have the mix of conditions with the lakes and the temperatures and the amount of snow we get, and that cause it to line up quite well.
Daniel, as I understand it, you're lying down in the boat during these races. And what are you doing to stay safe at speeds that can reach 100 miles an hour?
Well, the position of the skipper in the boat depends on what class of boat you're racing in. You are correct. In the largest ice sailing class in the world, which is called the DN, which is an abbreviation for the Detroit News. That's another whole story. But you are laying down on your back and steering with one arm and pulling a rope, which we refer to as a sheet, with the other arm. And, you know, that boat can go up to, you know, 55, 60 miles an hour. On the other end of the spectrum, a skeeter, which looks very much like a dragster, where the skipper is seated in the middle of the boat, which is 24 to 28 feet long, inside an airplane canopy, so protected from the elements, steering with foot pedals, and the sheet is controlled by a winch inside the cockpit. So it's a broad range of conditions for the skipper, depending on what boat they're in and whether they're completely outside, partially outside, or completely inside.
Daniel Hearn, we're just about out of time, but what's next for you out on the ice before we're done with winter?
Well, the International Skeeter Association Regatta has been called on tentatively for this coming Friday, Saturday, and Sunday on Green Lake, in Green Lake, Wisconsin.
Daniel, so I appreciate that. We'll have to leave it there, however, but thank you for joining us this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
Commodore Daniel Hearn of the Four Lakes Ice Yacht Club giving us an overview of hard water sailing and a preview of what could take place this weekend if conditions allow. We will stay tuned. WPR. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then an in-depth look at education through the eyes of the adults in the classroom. Why are more and more teachers pleading for a better way to learn or looking for a way out of their profession altogether? What are we missing amidst all the debates about education right now, and what does all of this education rancor do for our kids? That's coming up next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, conservative firebrand Sarah Palin took to the stand last week in a libel lawsuit she brought against the New York Times. We'll hear more about the judge's decision just this afternoon in the case and what it could mean for journalism in the U.S. going forward. But first, a new survey by the National Education Association found that more than half of teachers, 55%, say they plan on leaving the profession earlier than they had originally planned. The number bears that out. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 43% of teacher jobs are now going unfilled, and for all the teachers leaving, there aren't enough new teachers to replace them. Teaching colleges are seeing declining enrollment. The pandemic has made problems that already existed in the profession worse: low pay, stressful work. And we're talking about how the pandemic has affected the already stressful jobs of teachers today. And you can join in right now at 1-800-642-1234. Teachers, we want to hear from you. Has the pandemic made you reconsider your career advice? What have been the biggest challenges for you? Have you had to do extra work because colleagues have left? And what needs to change? What kind of support do you need going forward? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and happy to take your emails at ideas@wpr.org. Tim Slecker is the Director of Education Preparation Programs at Muskingum University. He was the Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College in Madison from 2013 to 2020. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Lee. Thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it.
It's good to have you back. I heard you talking to Rob, I don't know, 3 years ago on Central Time about this was not a teacher shortage. And here we are today with people saying this is a teacher shortage again. Tim, how do you see what's happening in the classroom with our educators?
Well, other than the COVID, the reality of what Rob and I talked about in 2019, again, the teacher shortage, whether we have one or not. Again, I know it's you know, semantics here, but one of the facts that I think listeners need to hear is that when I say there's no shortage, what I'm talking about is that what you said, the reality of the number of teachers leaving, the number of students who are not becoming teachers. So the pipeline into teacher education, the dips in enrollment teacher prep institutions are seeing. And maybe most important to hear this fact is that there are more licensed teachers in the United States than there are openings of teaching positions. So when I say there's no shortage of people who are qualified and able to teach. We then need to ask the question, what is happening in today's classrooms? And in 2019, there was a lot going on. And since COVID, the reality of what's happening in the classroom, what is it like to be a teacher? The reality of what it's like to be a teacher is that the work has become unsustainable. It's not joyful. Teachers who went into the profession for the whole reason to make a difference, to be that one person who was in their lives, to help children, they can't realize that vocational aspiration. And so their agency and the research I've been doing over the 3 years with over 400 teachers, the reality comes down to something sometimes really simple, which I hope we can get into, is they just want to be allowed to teach again.
Well, that sounds strange to hear teachers saying they just want to be allowed to teach again. What are they doing instead?
Well, okay. So at this point, we could look at COVID. It could be a many things. And so as the, now we'll use the word shortage, the number of people available to be involved in schools during COVID, whether it's school bus drivers, lunch personnel, custodial, and even the teachers, the reality is that the pitching in, and so I think the intro talked about teachers doing other things. Sometimes teachers right now are being called during their planning times, their other times, to either cover where they can't get personnel and or have three and four more classes put into the same classroom so that they can then supervise the students. So one of the things you're hearing is that we're doing a lot of supervision, not a lot of teaching with COVID right now. But the other part of this, what does it mean to say, I just want to teach? This is the long-term problem that has just really intensified with COVID is that for 30 plus years, we have been slowly telling teachers to account, when I use that word, the accountability movement, No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, Every Student Succeeds. There's been an imposition to take away agency, to take away professionalism from teachers and the realities and letting them make decisions about what's best for kids and putting in place rules where you have teachers who will say time and time again, if I follow this rule, this is not what's best for kids. If I do this, I'll be crossing a moral boundary. This is then, as they're saying in a lot of research, I'm demoralized. And when you hear about teachers saying, I need to leave, they were saying that in 2019. Throw everything COVID has thrown on top of teachers. And now why anybody is surprised to hear 50, 60% of teachers saying they're possibly thinking about not coming back as soon as next year. Nobody should be surprised by this. This has been out there. This has been happening now. The shortage, I said this before, is an exodus. The exodus is largely caused by the fact that we've had a large movement in the government, by think tanks, by everybody else to say, teachers, you can't do your job. We're going to mandate what it means for you to do your job. And taking away that professional agency and making teachers do things that they know are not in the best interests of kids, then of course the exit door is there and teachers are saying enough and they're out.
Tim Slecker is the director of educator preparation programs at Muskingum University. He was the dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College in Madison from 2013 to 2020. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Teachers, parents, students, for that matter, what's happening in the classroom right now and what can we do to restore some balance, I guess? So what are teachers asking you about, Tim, in terms of what they need and how they're going to find it?
Yeah, that's, you know, I think that's a great question. The fact that we're asking and talking about it right now, I just had a piece published at Diane Ravitch's blog over the weekend, kind of reacquainting people to the teacher shortage based on some of the interviews I've been doing over the past 3 years. And, you know, what are teachers saying we could be or should be doing? You know, when I said the simplicity of just let me teach, the reality then of looking at what that means is restoring professional autonomy and agency and creating a sense of maybe let's talk about why are people not going into teaching? I think that's the one. And when you said students, I'd love for you to, guys, if they're out there to call, because that's to me also one of the things that most people don't hear a lot about. I have at the time at Edgewood and now even here in my new position here in Ohio, I still meet with parents who talk about the fact that their child who's coming to investigate whether or not they want to be a teacher openly say they do not support their kid's decision to become a teacher. I've had more teachers say I would never tell a student to become a teacher again. And I've actually had students in high schools come out and point up to me that why would they ever want to take this position? They can actually see the demoralization in their teacher's eyes, the lack of respect. How do we then instill or reinstall respect to the profession? That's a great question. Part of the answer would be, first of all, recognizing the disrespect that is put out in front of teachers daily. It's recognizing and calling attention to the moment, Lee, when you're talking about what do? Before we do anything, the first thing we do is admit we have a real problem. We don't have a crisis of a shortage of teachers. We have a crisis of the profession. We have demoralized the profession. We have taken that choice away for for someone who wants to inspire to help people be better, to be better humans, to teach and learn. We've taken away that desire. We now have to point out this moment and say something's going on. So the solutions will come when we're able to admit the real problem.
And Tim, I want to circle back to this in a moment, but first let's go to Joe in Platteville, who wants to talk to you. Joe, you're on Central Time. Good afternoon.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I missed a little bit of what your guest said. I agree with a lot of what he has said, but Act 10, to me, just put a dagger into the moral and the morale that teachers had in the classroom. It was to make teachers seem like they were kind of leeching off of society because of what happened in 2008 and the fact they still had a job and had all these benefits and everything else. It just made teachers seem like we were, you know, leeches on society. And that put on what I think your guest is talking about, people not wanting to go into the profession.
Yeah, Joe, do you feel that legacy persists from Act 10 as you feel it?
Oh yeah, I think it really hurt the morale. I was teaching at that time, and it hurt the morale in our district substantially.
Joe, I appreciate the call, and that goes, Tim, to the heart of what you're talking about of the feeling that teachers are disrespected.
Yeah, think about. I mean, you know, Act 10, and when I was there, I had come right after Act 10 when I first got to Wisconsin and got there, and you know, that's an issue, and I know very personal to Wisconsin and Wisconsin teachers, and to hear Joe again remind us, but take all that in accumulation across the country, whether it's an Act 10, whether it's some form of taking away teacher autonomy, taking away teaching time. That's that weird thing we keep coming back to. Time allowed to teach, but not just allowed to teach, but to make curricular and instructional decisions that are best made at the local level within the classroom. Then throw in something like Act 10, which really was aimed at, as Joe pointed out, the fact that for some reason teachers had the nerve to have a job that paid them a wage and have benefits. And that was always, it was like, how is it that we turned that into the problem instead of the problem being people who don't have jobs with benefits? And so, as I said, this attack on teachers has come in multiple ways, whether it's coming at them from having a job with benefits or then coming at them from, quote, not doing their job, and we have kids who aren't learning, and therefore we need to blame them. And how we blame them is actually by taking away their professional expertise to teach, and we mandate curriculum, or as some people will say, we need a high-quality curriculum now to help teachers. No, we need to admit that we have taken the soul from teachers and stomped on it, crushed it, moved it around. And now we need to admit that we have to give back and restore and actually look at the teachers as the noble people that went into a profession, again, to help people become better humans. Recognizing that and recognizing that what I just said too, it's a profession. It's a moral profession that people make a decision to actually give up wages, to give up benefits, to help others. And the fact that we're routing people from this profession, that should be frightening people all across the country.
That's Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University, Tim Slecker. He is our guest, and we're asking you to join us at 1-800-642-1234. Teachers, parents, and students, how do you envision the future of teaching? How do you see it, its current state as it stands? We'll take your calls when we continue at 1-800-642-1234. That's next on Central Time. This is Central Time. On the Ideas Network, I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up our talk with Tim Slecker, Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University in Ohio. And we're talking about a new survey that found over half of teachers say they plan on leaving their profession sooner than they had originally planned. And we want to hear what you think about that at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tim Slecker is the Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University. And Tim, I want to ask you about UW-Madison School of Education, which has a teacher pledge program where teachers get financial support in return for working in Wisconsin's K through 12 schools for at least 3 years after graduation. You think this is a potential solution?
You know what? It's a move in the right direction that says that we have to do something different. My concern with any of these programs that are incentivizing people to become teachers is that if we're not looking at the conditions of what teachers are dealing with in the classrooms, what are the policies that situate and make up a teacher's day? What are the types of demands that we're putting on them when they get into the classroom? So, you know, supply side of this is one thing and to be thinking about. So incentives, of course, are great. But again, if we're only asking, you know, here a 3-year commitment, you know, that's not is the 3 years is not what's best for kids. It's better than teachers leaving in 1 and 2 years. I get that. But so besides incentivizing, we also have to have a direct approach that is looking at the culture of the classroom, the culture of schools, the culture of what it means to be a professional teacher day in and day out, because I'm concerned that we will spend more money incentivizing more people into a profession, and we're going to see more people continue to leave. And people are going to then come back and say, well, we spent money on it. We tried to fix it. Obviously, spending money isn't the solution. And so that, again, I think the UW is on the right track there, incentivizing people. But we're not going to make any difference in teachers leaving, because that's the real problem. It really is the real problem. You'll have more people go into teaching when more teachers stop leaving, and those teachers typically, and when those teachers then come out and they're models for why people want to become a teacher. So incentivizing people to get into teaching, definitely we have to be doing that. But man, if we do not do anything that deals with the reality of what it means to be a teacher day in and day out, we should not be surprised that at the end of 3 years, anybody who's incentivized monetarily to get into it, we should not be surprised when we see them leave right when they're done.
1-800-642-1234 to join our guest, Tim Slecker, Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University, where Michael in Mequon is standing by. Michael, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you think?
Well, I think when I'm in a classroom and I ask students what they want to do after high school, one of the things that I don't really hear too much of is, and this was touched on earlier, is, you know, I don't really want to be a teacher. And I think we have a lot of excellent students that could fulfill that, you know, that duty to society and something that bears a lot of responsibility for how our society functions and what they can do. And I think it's, as it was said, it's troublesome that, you know, students already see that is a path that they probably don't want to take on. And I think we really need to show in a number of ways how we value that if we really want to continue to be, you know, the great society of people that we are right now, if we'd like to be that.
So you're a teacher, Michael?
I am, yes.
Are you one of those who is considering leaving earlier than originally planned?
You know, I think it crosses everybody's mind. I think there are a number of things that draw me to it still. I think when I got into teaching, I came into it with a love for teaching the subjects that I have and loving to see the change that I could make when I was tutoring in college and helping out with middle school camps and helping younger students learn. And I think that still draws me, but there is a line that gets towed nearer, and it's tough to continue to look at teaching as this thing that, you know, I can do forever when there's all these challenges that we've been talking about.
If there was one thing that we could do for teachers in Wisconsin, Michael, from your perspective, what would that one thing be?
I liked the conversation about autonomy and giving teachers a platform to really show how they love to teach and to give them that autonomy to embrace their subject matter. In a way that maybe they don't feel they're able to dive into tougher topics and have discussions with their kids about why what they're learning matters and how it can be applicable to them in the future and to show them why teaching is so important to us.
Michael, thank you so much for the call. Tim Slecker, you heard from a teacher there, and autonomy seems to be, at least with the prevailing political debates about education, the other direction compared to where we're going, with calls now for cameras in the classroom and concerns over parents involved in the curriculum. It seems to be a stark contrast.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, you got to appreciate though what Michael just said, though. Again, you know, what is it? What would make a difference? That autonomy, that sense of a lot of giving them back the classroom. And yeah, at the exact same moment that we're hearing a solution to the teacher exodus would be professionalism, allowing them to teach. You actually see legislation coming out telling teachers what they can't teach. Telling professionals who are history teachers that you can't teach facts if they make children uncomfortable. These are the types of challenges that I said, when you create a toxicity around the profession of teaching, people should not be surprised that we don't have students who want to go into it. And that is a huge fear. So when Michael says, I'm concerned about, kids in front of him that don't want to be teachers, we should be really concerned. The fact is that children themselves are already downloading that teaching is not a place to make a difference in the lives of others. And if people...
But it is, though, Tim, right? I mean, you and I both know it.
And that, you know what? Yeah, thanks, Lee, for bringing me back off of my cliff. Because the reality is that... But this is the importance, because these are the people that make a difference in all of our lives. These are the people that create the doctors, the engineers, the lawyers, the farmers, everybody else. And so when you take down our profession, the teaching profession, please recognize the harm that you're actually causing to society in general, and maybe even in your local community. And so that's when I ask people, would you really want some of the things that you see happening nationally happening locally at your school? If the answer is, oh my goodness, no, we love our teachers, they do a great job, well, then it's time to get out and start telling them that and reversing the policies that have stripped away that professional agency so they can advocate and teach to the best of their ability for what's best for kids.
Tim, we're out of time, but I thank you for yours.
Thank you very much, Lee.
Tim Slecker, Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to an expert in First Amendment law about Sarah Palin's libel lawsuit against the New York Times and the judge's decision to throw the case out just this afternoon. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.